Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. Hello, and welcome to Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares your favorite Hollywood movies with history. Today, we're going to be looking at the 1956 movie, The Conqueror. That movie was actually included in a 1978 book from film critics Harry and Michael Medved and Randy Dreyfuss called The 50 Worst Films of All Time. It's because The Conqueror is regarded by many to be one of the worst films of all time. To help us separate fact from fiction, we'll be chatting with screenwriter and author of the book Killing John Wayne, The Making of the Conqueror, Ryan Udawilligan. Before we chat with Ryan, though, it's time to set up our game. Two truths and a lie. If you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'm about to say three things. Two of them are true, and that means one of them is an all-out lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number one. Temujin's motivations for conquering was revenge for Bortai, his wife. Number two, Jumuga was more of a rival to Temujin. Number three, Temujin and Bortai did not meet for the first time as adults like we see in the movie. Got him? Okay, now as you're listening to our story today, your challenge is to find the two facts scattered somewhere throughout the episode. Maybe it's going to be obvious, maybe not. Can you find out which one is a lie? We'll do a recap at the end of the episode to see how well you did. All right, now it's time to connect with Ryan Udawilligan about The Conqueror. We'll dive into some of the details of the movie in a moment, but before we do that, if we take a step back and had to give The Conqueror a letter grade for historical accuracy from an overall perspective, what would it get?
Well, is this out of just A to F, or is this the whole alphabet?
I suppose we can make some special exceptions.
Yeah, if we start with Z and then just go beyond there and make a letter, because, yeah, it's... Don't watch The Conqueror if you're looking to learn something about history.
Great. Well, so there's a big elephant in the room I want to address up front. The movie is from 1956. It still doesn't really excuse it from some inexcusable things. Right up front, John Wayne as Genghis Khan, Susan Hayward as Bortai. Certainly not the first time that Hollywood has done what's now known as yellowface, casting white people in the place of Asian roles. I know Mickey Rooney's character, probably one of the most popular. But I also know that you dedicated a chapter in your book about this.
Yes.
Can you give us an overview of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, of course. It's something that, you know, was unavoidable to talk about. And it just seemed more and more fitting to, you know, not just address it, but explore it and the root of why it was happening. And so in the book, I give somewhat of an overview. I had initially included like the origins of blackface makeup as well, but just to keep with the theme of the actual movie, I talk about the history of yellowface makeup. And then especially at that time in the 1950s, it was just like nobody cared. Like they were initially going to cast Marlon Brando as Genghis Khan, then they wanted Yul Brynner. So there was never any Asian actor ever considered to be in the role. And you know, back then it wasn't considered, unfortunately. There was not a lot of viable quote-unquote stars or, you know, people that they would let on screen as opposed to smaller, more, you know, servant type roles that they would normally cast Asian actors in that were demeaning, and it's taken forever to actually get proper representation. But yeah, they didn't bat an eye here, and they would bring John Wayne in to color his face, get the right skin tones. They used elastic bands to, get the correct, as they call it, eye slant, to play the role. And again, no one really questioned it beyond the director, Dick Powell, who was sort of brought on as a hired gun. And he sort of said, really? John Wayne is Genghis Khan? And then he didn't say anything because everyone was like, yeah, of course, he's John Wayne. So really, there was no producer in the room or anybody who was saying, no, this is a bad idea, this is insensitive. And it would take decades after this, Marlon Brando turned down the role so he could play another one. I believe it's now the title just escapes me, but he also plays a Japanese owner of a tea house. And then you mentioned Mickey Rooney's famous characterization in Breakfast at Tiffany's, movie that I love. But yeah, looking back at a lot of these movies, they do not age well at all because of this. And you know, it's hard to explain to people like what was going through the mind. You're trying to, you know, I don't want to defend their decisions, but at the same time, like, they, you know, there was definitely racism at play behind the decisions, but it wasn't as thought of and as calculated as some might seem.
They didn't think about it, and maybe that's the problem. They didn't think about it.
Exactly. No, John Wayne owed RKO Studios 3 movies. He did 2, and he just wanted to get the contract overdone with. So he picked this movie, and they cast him, and that was that. So, you know, it sounds like a crazy casting misfire, and a lot of critics at the time even pointed that out. But still, no one batted an eye. They just said, okay, this is what you want to do? Great. Moving on.
Well, something else I wanted to address up front, and it's another elephant in the room when you're talking about this movie, just the blatant sexism in the movie. There's throughout the entire movie, Bortai is treated like a possession. She gets hit, she's thrown around, he's forced to marry, things like that. You know, lots of abuse that we see both on the screen, and plenty is implied, like when she's forced to share a tent with Temujin. Was this sort of abuse common in that era, like in history, or is that more of a Hollywood thing? Again, we're talking about, you know, another issue with Hollywood.
Well, absolutely. It was definitely commonplace in that time, in Genghis Khan's time. So they probably scaled it down quite a bit because of Hollywood censorship. But this movie is, yeah, very sexist as opposed to a lot of movies that were coming out at the time, even though Howard Hughes took over RKO in 1948, and generally what a lot of people figured he did that for is so he could contract young starlets and just abuse them. He would have this whole long list of young actresses who were trying to make it big, and he was the big producer, and you know, he just kind of had them all on speed dial and like, okay, I'll put you in this movie if you do something for me. And so that was what he was doing for about 5 or 6 years, and even afterwards when he sold the studio. The word on the street is he went on a date with Susan Hayward in the late 40s. It did not go well, and he held that against her and wanted to get revenge. So this movie is pretty awful, and the role is, as you said, like, she's basically just a possession. She has to do some terrible dancing, like almost a striptease at one point, and she's just being passed sometimes in some scenes by one character to another, just high above the ground. They, like, one scene, John Wayne just inexplicably laughs and then picks her up, and that's the end of the scene. Like, okay, that's great. But a lot of people think that Howard Hughes recognized that this is a terrible role, and he cast her in there to embarrass her and get his revenge. So yeah, a lot of it was just because of Howard Hughes's tastes. He was making a lot of these types of movies at that time, like one called Son of Sinbad, and it's all about these harems, and I think there's about four or five different movies that he did at that point of time, where it's just a lot of scantily clad ladies doing dancing for no reason whatsoever, just sort of an interlude to appease his sexist tastes.
We started off with two great things there. Wow.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's a lot of that. I address it in the book as well, because there's just, you know, there's so much to dive in. Is like, what's so wrong with this movie?
So many things. And we haven't even gotten to the historical side yet. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in the opening sequence, speaking of kind of going to more of the historical, we see Temujin attack a Merkit caravan to capture Bortai. She's explained in the movie as a Tartar woman who's being held by the chief. And then after the battle, he takes her away, basically kind of sets up the rest of the events that we see in the movie. After capturing her, he finds out that she's the daughter of Kumlik, who was the Tartar chief that apparently poisoned Temujin's father. We find that out later on in the movie. How does the movie do depicting how Temujin and Bortai met?
Not well. I don't know if you know personally much of the history of Genghis Khan and sort of what.
It's been a while since I've researched it, that's for sure.
Okay. Yes. Well, they both were children when they met, really. You know, what it's theorized, they were between the ages of 9 and 12. So John Wayne is 50 years old in this movie. And so obviously very tweaked and changed for that, because it was somewhat of an arranged marriage at that point. You know, they weren't officially married, but it was sort of a set thing when they were children that they were to be married at some point. And so this stealing a Bortai and then rescuing her afterwards in real life, they were married after that situation and became a couple. But here, yes, there's sort of the, I don't want to call it a meet cute at the beginning, but they do meet each other in the desert, and it's definitely not how it went.
As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes that's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers. Get the peace of mind that comes with EarnIn. Download EarnIn today, spelled EARNIN, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, EarnIn.
After that attack that we see in the movie, we see the Merkit chief, Targatai, I believe is his name. He retaliates by attacking Temujin's home. He burns a lot of the houses, frees the horses, but then Temujin kills him, and then he plans his attack on Kumlik, which, as I was watching this, it didn't seem like anything that he really wanted to do at the beginning of the movie. It just seems like all this kind of falls into his lap, and so the impression I got was all of this is centered around Bortai. Is there any truth to that?
Not really. There of course was when they, you know, rescued her, brought her back, and then they were married. That's basically the only little blip that's actually true here. The fun fact that I like to tell people that I found out about the screenwriter Oscar Millard, he didn't know who Genghis Khan was when he took the meeting to write this script. He was brought on as a writer for hire, and he was a really smart guy. He'd been nominated for an Academy Award for writing a couple of years beforehand. And he, before he took the meeting, like, was just thumbing through encyclopedia and then had to look it up and like, okay, this is who they're referring to. This is what Genghis Khan means. They took the meeting and went in that way, completely blind. So, you know, back in those days, a lot of these biblical epics were a lot more classical and trying to, you know, be entertaining for modern audiences with a romance. So they really played up the actual romance point of view and you know, relationship between Bortai and Temujin, because it's, you know, it's really not how it played out. It was a lot, well, we don't know. We don't know what kind of love or relationship that they actually did have, but here it's a lot more flirtatious, almost will they, won't they, and really driving what Temujin wanted to do and conquer, when really, you know, that relationship didn't drive him much.
So what was his driver then? Was essentially building the empire was his driver?
Yeah, absolutely. Land and power.
Okay. Okay. I mean, that makes sense. Just not what we get from the movie at all.
No, and that would be a very different movie. And it's more truthful, but usually in these types of movies, a motivation like that, how do you convey that? Just in maybe better hands, you could have a better story. But, you know, in the 50s, a character who's bent on just getting more land and conquering, it doesn't jive with the type of movies they were making and wanted to tell.
In one of the battles that we see in the movie between the Mongols and the Tartars, Temujin is shot with an arrow and he's captured. He does manage to escape. Conveniently, there's a cave nearby that he can hide in while the rest of his soldiers get routed. It seemed like a pretty significant defeat. Were there any defeats like that where Temujin barely made it away alive?
Not that I could find. With the movie, you know, it kind of happens with the screenwriter lingo. It's the all is lost point where he's at his weakest. And so obviously they had to include something to make it seem like he's not going to make it when he obviously is this grand conqueror. But Genghis Khan actually died from an illness, and they're not sure what it was. And some scholars have pinpointed it that he actually in battle fell off his horse and then contracted something, and it festered inside him for a couple of months and then he died. But, you know, they're really not sure. It's just this mysterious illness that he died of. And I'm sure he did get struck with arrows. And I don't know. With the amount of people that he had fighting with him, there was no way that he was going to be cast off alone like this. And in his very young days, so he was at his weakest point when his father was actually killed. But, you know, he would have been just a boy and sort of fending off for himself at that point. So nothing, unfortunately, that's what is depicted in the movie.
Well, you brought up something that made me curious, because in the movie, at the timeline of the movie, his father is already dead. But then you were saying that, you know, Genghis Khan and Bortai actually met, you know, as kids. So obviously, you know, there's an age difference there. What timeline is the movie trying to be in?
I wish I knew. I don't know that the screenwriters and the actual people behind it knew, because, you know, there's a lot of little interesting facts. And when you go and look at his life, it's so huge, and a lot of it is spent conquering land. But there is that tiny little blip that is, well, he, you know, and it would have been better, I think, if they did it, you know, knowing that, oh yeah, well, Bortai and him have history, and then she's kidnapped and he goes to rescue her. It's kind of like that in the movie. But I think they really played that up because that's where a sense of adventure and sort of grand old storytelling of going to rescue the damsel in distress comes from. So I think they just extrapolated that little tiny portion, and they threw in a couple of real life characters and made quite a few of them up, and that's really what we get as far as a representation of history. You know, it's a small point, somewhat of an origin story, you could call it, of Genghis Khan.
Would it be correct to basically say they're essentially cherry picking things and then throwing it together into a new story almost?
Basically, yeah. You really can't identify a time period in his life that would be accurate. I mean, he would be a young person in, you know, his teens at this point when this was happening and this actual rescue took place. But, you know, then a good 10 years goes by where he's conquering all of the other tribes and then finally receives the title Genghis Khan. So, yeah, it's a you see that a lot in movies, so you can't really focus and hold this one up and fault it because of that, because a lot of movies do pick and take little pieces of time periods and switch them around to make it more palatable for audiences. And, you know, probably the lesser sin that this movie committed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it is common in movies, and it makes sense. I mean, you're trying to take years and years and throw it in here. I just didn't know if there was a particular part that they were trying to focus on within his life, or if they really were just kind of picking and choosing and pulling, as is common.
The word on the street is Howard Hughes just showed up one day to the office, the RKO offices or whoever he was communicating with, and just said, we should do a movie about Genghis Khan, just out of the blue. Okay. So they tried to get it going and ultimately did it with John Wayne. But yeah, there was really, when you look at him and the screenwriter, there was really no like yearning, like, oh, let's tell this history. Let's really get into this and represent something. It was like, oh, biblical epics are popular. Genghis Khan. Okay. Off we go.
Wow. A lot of forethought put into that.
Yes.
Well, if we head back to the movie, we see Temujin gathering clans of Mongols going to war against Kumlik. In addition to the Mongol clans, he also tries to get help from his father's blood brother, Wang Khan. He sends his brother, I think two of his brothers actually, it was kind of iffy. There were some parts where it kind of mentioned Kassar was his brother, but I wasn't sure if they were referring to actually like actual biological brother, if that's what they mean, or if they're just kind of saying.
From what I understand, I believe it's just, you know, they sort of call each other brother all throughout. So I think that was just sort of the clan speak they were trying to go for.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was that or if it was actually a, you know, biological thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then they go to try to get Wang Khan's armies, which we never really see, but we assume that, you know, these are big armies, right? And then the shaman gets in the way. He has Kassar killed. He goes to Temujin and tells him that Wang Khan is not going to send his armies. We're just going to watch and wait for you to be destroyed. And so then he convinces Temujin to turn on his father's blood brother and take the city for his own. And the shaman even goes in there and mortally wounds the Khan. The next day we see the generals swearing allegiance to Temujin. He declares himself not only the chief of the Mongols, also the ruler over any of the possessions of Wang Khan. It just, it's a big turn, right? And I know that there's a lot thrown in there. It just happens pretty quickly in the movie as well. But how does the movie do showing this? And kind of, that almost seems to be his rise to power in the movie, where he was a leader to begin with, but now he's the big leader.
Yes, exactly. And he was a leader. From what I understand, that little portion is true with Wang Khan and you know, actual the turning on it and the battle. That from what I understand is one of the only little accurate parts, but it's only a very small portion of it. In all of what I could find, like you mentioned the character of Kumlik. I don't believe that character existed. I think that was a fictional representation. And that's what they did a lot, like with this movie, like the sidekick Jamuga, who was, you know, they even changed the spelling, was more of a rival to Genghis Khan or Temujin. They, you know, they worked together a little bit earlier on in his life, but, you know, they actually fought each other and That's something that is kind of hinted to towards the end of the story. But yes, most of these representations are either amalgamations of different characters or just completely fictional entirely.
What was his rise to power then? Did he take over Wing Khan and then become the great leader that was?
It took a long time. Like it took, it's a very simplistic battle here. As you get one fight, when it took, I think, around 10 years for him to wipe out all the other different tribes, because there were the Tartar tribes and different people who were constantly standing up to him, or he would go and send his armies that would constantly grow and then pillage and take over. So I think, between what's depicted there with Wing Khan, it was another 10 years of actually rising to power until he was finally recognized as the great universal ruler.
Well, that makes it sound a lot more deliberate than the movie, for sure, because in the movie, you have that shaman character that I think he was even cast as shaman. So,
Yeah, who's definitely fictional.
Yeah. But it just seems maybe the shaman character had been planning something like this for a while, but it seems, as far as from Temujin's point of view, like a last minute just turning on his friends type moment. Whereas if it actually took 10 years, that's a little more deliberate.
Absolutely. They're going to shrink that down to make it, to make it a drama and a more of a dramatic choice. But it's not representative. It was a lot more fighting and strategy and, a longer rise to power.
Well, there is a scene in the Tartar village where Boytai, she was rescued by her father, from Temujin. And then she says something about, she tells Jamuga that, I'll gladly betray my father, cast my people into Mongol bondage just to be in Temujin's arms, right? She says she's consumed with the want of him. It just seems like, a really fast turn that all of a sudden, this guy that she hates treats her terribly throughout the entire movie, both before and after her apparently falling for him. It just seems like a real fast turn. But even from what you're saying before, it sounds like there's probably not much accuracy to that turn in Vortai's.
No, she has a very sudden love for him that makes absolutely no sense. And it's, even as a screenwriting standpoint, it just, there's no motivation other than, she was kind of saved by him, that he's a rippling strong man. That's really all that she has to go on. She's not a developed character. And so, that relationship isn't very convincing. But when you look back at what they actually did have to go on, what I said before, where they were children when they were first met. So, there's, a very different historical standpoint to draw on that way. But a lot of marriages back then were, and still are, unfortunately, arranged or, exchange for land, an exchange for power or armies. So there wasn't a lot of Hollywood romance thrown into the mix. It was a lot more, it was a lot quicker for sure, and a lot more pairings that were made that, unfortunately had nothing to do with love.
So it was, their marriage actually was an arranged marriage. Was Boytai then like the daughter of a chief or something?
I believe it started that way. There was, they didn't meet and fall in love. It was, one tribe and another that it was sort of alluded to, and then it didn't happen because she, I believe that's when Temujin's father died, and so it got put on hold. That's when she was taken, and after all of that took place, then the actual marriage. I don't know if there's any dates available out there what age they were, but it happened sometime after that point.
Okay, so she it was for merging tribes, essentially. It was kind of for a political purpose.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Not like what we see in the movie. Yeah. 'Cause even in the beginning, in that opening scene, like when he first sees her, there's nothing really political about it. He didn't even know that she was the daughter of the guy who killed his dad at first in the movie.
No, it's love at first sight. She's just sort of riding on this little, not a chariot, but like being carried throughout the desert. And she looks stunning, like she has never set foot in a desert before. And of course, you know, it's Susan Hayward. So she's got red hair and makeup and Hollywood glamour radiating. So yeah, of course he's going to fall in love with this actress, this portrayal, but it's nothing to do with real life.
Well, I have a feeling I might know the answer to the next question then, because near the end of the movie,
yeah,
it leads up to this big battle, right? And the big battle is between Temujin and Kumlek. There's cavalry on both sides. Interestingly, I didn't see any infantry fighting. It's just cavalry. And then during the battle, you know, the two leaders, of course, have to face head to head. And then the battle itself between Temujin and Kumlek is like just a couple seconds long. Before Temujin kills him, you said Kumlek was probably a fictional character anyways.
A fictional character, probably a representation of, you know, many, he had many battles, he killed many people, killed many leaders. So, you know, probably my best guess is that the screenwriter just needed some sort of villain, some sort of character to add in the end. And as you said, like, it's very anticlimactic, like it just sort of happens and then that's it. It's a very, for a movie that is fairly epic and has, you know, some battle sequences and taking place in the desert, it's wrapped up very quickly, but it's, you know, they have little historical details to explore, and they just, yeah, they have that character Kumlek, who, you know, they didn't really have much motivation for him either, so they just decided to obviously axe him, because, you know, Genghis Khan obviously continues on after the point of this movie. So, or the point of the story that they were telling in the movie.
Yeah. I actually had to watch that scene twice because I was watching it and I was taking notes I was watching it as I usually do. And then it was over. I was like, wait, what did I miss? What? Like, this is the big fight at the end. What? It's over? I had to go back and watch it again. Okay. It was just very anticlimactic. Yeah. At the end there, after Kumlek is killed in the movie, there's a line in the movie where Jimuga tells his brother that you have no need of me henceforth, my brother. You have found your destiny. Far greater conquests will be yours, Temujin, and men will call you, he pronounces it Genghis Khan, the perfect warrior. And that's the only time throughout the movie that Temujin is called Genghis Khan. Is that the true story of how he got the title?
No. Jimuga did not instill that. There were, we don't really know where that title came from, but it did sort of happen. Like at the end, there's sort of a ceremony or a big celebration. That part is accurate. Like eventually he was, after that sort of 10-year long rise to the top, you know, he was dubbed Genghis Khan, which is, you know, universal ruler. So we don't know who gave it to him, but it sort of was this honor that was bestowed upon him by all of his followers, when really he had little people at that time to actually fight with. He reached the top. So that part is how it is depicted, not by who gives him the title. And again, it could have been anyone. It could have been this collective group, or just something that had been talked about or starting to call him this name, and then it starts to gain popularity. Maybe that's what happened as well. But, you know, he was celebrated in this big way and officially called by this name through a celebration.
And I mean, I guess you reach the top. Maybe he just gave it to himself. I mean, when you're at the top, I guess you can do whatever you want.
It could be. It could be. Yeah. There's a lot of speculation.
We do get some voiceover at the very end of the movie that says the great Khan made such conquests as were undreamed of by mortal men. And then it says for 100 years, the children of their loins, speaking of Temujin and Bortai, ruled half the world. I thought it was very interesting that ending there, because as I was watching that, I realized, you know, I'm watching this movie and it's called The Conqueror. And really the only thing that we really see him, or the only mention of him making these huge conquests and conquering is that little bit of dialogue at the end, you know, throughout the story. And I'm sure this could be an entire podcast series in and of itself, but for Genghis Khan's real conquest, since we don't really see those in the movie, can you give us kind of a brief overview or kind of a timeline of what actually happened in his life?
A small bit, yeah. It was a lot of leading men, a lot of battles, and a lot of expanding forward, through China, a little bit of Korea, all the way to, like, there was reaches all the way to Afghanistan and that area. So, you know, there was just, yeah, a lot of conquering for, as we touched on before, for power, for land, and just for ultimate dominance. And then he does die in an anticlimactic way, not in a battle, but because he falls of illness. And yes, there's always that fact that a lot of people like to bring up, that there's a certain, and that it doesn't help that percentage escapes my memory right now, that there's a amount of lineage today that people can be traced back to Genghis Khan because of all the raping and unfortunate business that he was doing was popular in that time. And that's the weird thing about the movie as well. Like, it was filmed in the 50s in a very conservative time, and they portray him as a very noble, strong, mighty ruler, but they don't even touch any of the negative parts. We see him as a mighty conqueror, some of us do, but he's a very controversial figure because obviously he committed so many, they weren't crimes, it was just the way of conquering, and that was just murder and torture and rape and having multiple wives. I think there was more than just Bortai. But yeah, they obviously couldn't put that in a movie at that time. And Genghis Khan, John Wayne even said that he wanted to play the role as a gunfighter and saw Genghis Khan as a cowboy. So he approached it in that direction. And so obviously you get no representation, no accurate representation in that way. There's been a couple movies, I think, that's depicted his life. Nothing out of Hollywood. There was a Chinese movie called Mongol that came out in 2007, and that was somewhat of a very popular and accurate representation. There was a couple movies also in the 50s that sort of used Genghis Khan as a villain, but nothing ever has really been portrayed. So I think now, when you get a lot of limited series like Vikings or Rome or things like that, I think the story of Genghis Khan and what you can show now, what you could tell because of the moral ambiguity, I think the story is probably ripe for the picking for a show in the coming years.
Yeah. Yeah. And to tell it a little bit more accurately than The Conqueror.
Exactly. And it's so old is the thing too. I mean, this happened in the end of the 1100s, early 1200s. So much is lost and a lot is only speculated. So, you know, I don't have a lot of knowledge to share with you because there's a few details of battles, but his day-to-day life and the sort of the kind of person that he was, it's all orally told through people who had memories and very little is available. So, you know, what is available, obviously, the screenwriter and filmmakers of The Conqueror just tossed right out and used only tiny bits and pieces. But
well, and that's the way it is with history. Sometimes we don't, there's a lot that we don't know. And, you know, that can give the ability to fill in some of those holes in movies and things like that. But also you can just throw it out and just like this one. Well, speaking of the movie, I know the movie, this one in particular, did have a lot of controversy about where it was filmed, the illnesses befalling the cast and crew after it was made. Can you share a little bit more about what happened?
Yeah, well, it was filmed in near downwind of the Nevada nuclear test site, right after they had been busy ramping up all these tests in the early 50s. And so they chose this area just outside of St. George, Utah, called Snow Canyon, and they wanted to emulate the Gobi Desert, and they looked in shooting in Mongolia. Obviously, that was way too far, so they picked this little spot, didn't really do their homework, and it was about 130-some miles downwind of this test site, and a lot of wind had blown nuclear fallout that specifically piled into that area. So a lot of people in that area, St. George, Utah, a little bit of Nevada, they were actually getting sick in the late 50s, all throughout the 60s, getting cancer, a lot of stillbirths, a lot of sheep had a lot of strange growths, and they couldn't really quite figure out why until the late 60s, early 70s, and they pinpointed it was because of the nuclear tests. And then you also had, related to the film, you had director Dick Powell, actors like Susan Hayward, Pedro Armendariz, Agnes Moorehead, they all died of cancer. John Wayne got cancer in 64, had a piece of his lung removed and actually beat it, but then he got cancer again in the late 70s and died from it. But in between there, he became sort of an advocate for cancer research. A lot of people speculate it's because of their smoking. All of these people, including John Wayne, were pack-a-day smokers who would, you know, just constantly puff away. And so it's a rumor that we'll never really be able to prove and know. You know, there is real downwinder cases. There was a long battle through Congress to actually get an apology and some reparations for families who lost people because of nuclear testing contamination, and finally they got ahead in the early 90s and started to receive money and apologies and recognition. But the people who were involved in this film, it's not just the stars, it's dozens of cast members and crew members, extras. They had hundreds of extras who were Native tribe members from Utah and the area, and they'll never know how many people actually died because they were brought into that contaminated area. But yeah, it's this constantly contested rumor.
You mentioned some legislation. Was there any legislation around the movie itself or anything tied to that?
What The Conqueror did was help shed some light on the issue, because there was famous faces who were dying and a couple of journalists who sort of pieced that together. And that happened in the late 70s, early 80s. And that was sort of the big breakthrough for the downwinders to actually get attention and get something moved through the government. But they allotted only certain payments for people who lived or were present in these states that were contaminated at certain pockets of time. And because of the film shoot, which was only a couple months, and it was a couple of about a full year after the last nuclear test, the government just deemed that they were ineligible. So no one from the movie actually got any reparations, any forgiveness. There was one extra who really sort of took it on upon herself to try and fight for you at least get some sort of apology or attention, Jeannie Gerson. And then she died in the early 90s. She had cancer, I think, about at least three times and ultimately died of it. So, yeah, again, it's still, as I put the book out here, it's still a subject that people love bringing up every now and then because it's such a strange rumor. Like, oh, John Wayne and this whole cast and crew were plagued by cancer because of nuclear contamination. We'll never know. We have people, scientists who say yes. We have scientists who say no. Government officials, it goes back and forth. But, you know, decades have gone by, well over 50 years, 60 years. So it's just, unfortunately, yeah, it's in the past.
Nobody wants to accept responsibility for it.
Yeah.
There's something else as I was trying to find the film to watch it as I prepare for that. I couldn't find it on any streaming service. I had to buy the DVD to watch it. That's not the first time I've had to do that. But while I was looking for it, I noticed something about how Howard Hughes bought all of the prints and then kept it away from the public for a while. What's that story?
He's the most fascinating man who ever lived.
I thought that was the beer guy, isn't that? Most interesting man, never mind.
Yeah, that's right. Him, yes, and Howard Hughes. He just had his finger in every pie, this guy. And then eventually in 1955, after driving the studio into the ground, he sold RKO. And they tried to get things back onto their feet. Ultimately, they couldn't, and they released The Conqueror. It didn't make back its money. So they closed the doors of this magnificent studio. And so Howard Hughes approached them and bought back The Conqueror and another movie that he and John Wayne made called Jet Pilot. And there really was no clear reason. Some people think that he just loved the movie so much and the negative reception sort of bothered him. So he gathered it all. Some people think that the nuclear contamination and the deaths of everyone was responsible. But it really couldn't have been, because he bought up the rights to this movie before those deaths started to happen. I think it was just something ultimately that he wanted to keep for himself and maybe try and make more money on at a certain point. But then he did start buying up all the prints, and that's where it gets a little murky if it was, because it happened all throughout the 60s, if it was him, you know, scooping up this because the movie was such a terrible mess and he was embarrassed by it, or he felt bad for what was happening. Again, we'll never know, but it was essentially a lost film for about 20 years. No one saw it. It didn't play on TV. RKO was one of the first studios to actually lend out their film library and start playing them on television with two absent movies, which being The Conqueror and the other one. And then at the end of Howard Hughes' life, when he was in Las Vegas hotels and kind of losing his mind because of germs and all these different phobias, he would request his staff to put on The Conqueror and play it on repeat, so he would watch it just 100 times over from his bed. A lot of people said that he was attracted to John Wayne and his portrayal. He was attracted to the mighty Conqueror image that maybe he saw in himself. We'll never know, but that was something that was happening at the end of his life. And then ultimately, yeah, it was finally released on VHS in the mid-80s. And because of all these stories of contamination, it sort of took on a different life. And from then on out, it's been hard to find. When you do find it, it's usually referencing the poor reception, the miscasting, or the nuclear story. So occasionally you can find it on TCM, but it's sort of a print by order basis. It's run through Universal now. And so I'm sure that's how you got it, is if you order it through them, they just manufacture one of these DVDs and send it to you. But there's really not a lot of these copies floating around in stores. That's for sure. It took me a while to hunt one down.
Watching the movie on repeat, that would drive me crazy, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's what did him in. It was watching The Conqueror over and over.
Wow. Well, okay, let's say you were in charge of this movie. What's something you would have done differently? Or would it be easier just to say the one thing you would have kept the same?
But it's all these sins, these mistakes that I think keep it in its public eye and that people keep revisiting it. It's sort of this, it's so bad, it's good kind of realm. So if I were to change something, it wouldn't be well known anymore. I think if you change the casting of John Wayne and cast someone more suitable for the role, it would sort of fall into obscurity. And it wouldn't have mattered as much. Or if you actually filmed it where it was supposed to, maybe somewhere different, you know, I would probably do those two things if I was going to make this movie, film it somewhere safer and more proper and cast someone more appropriate. But yeah, it's we got a very different tale out of it because of those mistakes.
Yeah, it just would have been another bad movie that nobody knows about.
Yeah, precisely.
Well, speaking of coming back into the public eye, your latest book is all about the making of the movie. Can you share an overview of your book and let someone listening to this know where they can learn more about your work?
Yeah, it's Killing John Wayne, The Making of the Conqueror. It covers every possible side that you could think of related to this movie. So how Howard Hughes decided to buy RKO and run it into the ground and make all these terrible movies. And this was sort of the big climax, the magnum opus, and how John Wayne got involved with Hughes and RKO and owed them three movies. And then the actual problematic shoots. And then there's a lot of nuclear history as well, something I didn't know much about but found so interesting. Not the actual, well, there is a lot of nuclear science in there, but I'm not a nuclear scientist. I'm a film historian. So I really touch on the cultural aspects of what was going on when these nuclear tests started happening in the late 40s, and how people would travel to Las Vegas just to feel the rumble of the nearby tests. And people in the area were urged to actually come and watch the tests unfold. And then I touch on a lot of the private lives that sort of intersect around this movie, of the stars and people that were involved. And unfortunately, this the latter half is a lot of death and a lot of despair of trying to get some light onto the actual aftermath, not just of the Conqueror crew and cast, but of downwinders in general.
Yeah, it's a story to tell, that's for sure.
Yeah, there's so many different facets. So if you like film history, if you like American history, nuclear history, if you like the history of business and how a movie studio, like the studio collapse and is sort of at the end of the studio system in the golden age of Hollywood. So there's really something in it for everyone if you're interested at all. And you could pick it up in any bookstore, have it ordered through, you know, any of the book suppliers that you go through, or Amazon.
Perfect. And I'll make sure to include a link to that in the show notes for this episode as well. Thank you so much for coming on a chat about The Conqueror.
Perfect. Thank you very much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
This episode of Based on a True Story was produced by me, Dan Lefebvre. I'd like to thank Ryan Udwell again, once again, for sharing his expertise about the movie The Conqueror. If you want to hear more stories about the making of what many consider to be one of the worst movies ever made, some will actually say it is the worst movie ever made, go check out Ryan's excellent book about making that movie called Killing John Wayne, The Making of The Conqueror. You can find all his work at ryanudewilliganauthor.com, or as always, you can find links to his books in the show notes for this episode, as well as on the show's Home on the Web, Based on a True Story podcast.com. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and a lie game from the beginning of the episode. And as a refresher, here are the two truths and one lie. Number one. Temujin's motivations for conquering was revenge for Bortai, his wife. Number two, Jamuga was more of a rival to Temujin. Number three, Temujin and Bortai did not meet for the first time as adults like we see in the movie. Did you find out which one is a lie? Let's count backward and start with number three. Temujin and Bortai did not meet for the first time as adults like we see in the movie. It is true that the movie got the way Temujin and Bortai met completely wrong. As Ryan pointed out, the two actually met as kids and not adults like we see in the movie. That brings us to number two. Jamuga was more of a rival to Temujin. That is also true. The relationship we see between Temujin and Jamuga in the movie does not really reflect the true history of what actually happened. That means number one is the lie. Temujin's motivations for conquering was revenge for Bortai, his wife. A lot of the movie suggests Bortai was at the center of Temujin's motivations for, well, almost everything. The truth is, Temujin's motivations to conquer lands was, well, to conquer lands. Basically, the same drivers a lot of conquerors throughout history have had, money and power. Last but not least, it's time now to let you know how long it took to create this episode. If you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you'll know I like to share this information just to help you appreciate all the podcasts that you listen to. After all, a huge majority of podcasts are, like mine, completely free to listen to, but that doesn't mean that they're free to create. Quite the opposite. They can cost a lot of money, but almost every podcast out there has even higher costs than money. They have high costs in time, the time it takes to learn the technical side, to research the technical side, to keep up on it, to keep up on the episodes, to research the episodes, record them, edit them, and so on. But I only have these statistics for my own show, so with that in mind, today's episode took a total of 42 hours to create. To make it clear, that's only my time. It does not include any of Ryan's time. And to be even more specific, it doesn't even include all of my time, because that 42 hours is only the time that it took for me to produce this one episode. It doesn't include all the time I spend building, maintaining the Based on True Story website, finding new guests, scheduling, logistics, social media, or recently, behind the scenes, entirely migrating podcast hosts. All of those things, they don't really have anything to do with just making today's one episode, but they're still required and things that need to be done to make the podcast overall. In a nutshell, this podcast may be free to listen to, but it is not free to create. And that's why I'm so thankful for the sponsors whose ads you've heard on this episode. You can find out more information about them over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/advertisers. But they're not the only ones helping to keep the show alive. There are wonderful people just like you who are helping to keep this show financially going. So if you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you'll consider supporting the next episode over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Once again, you can learn how to support the show at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. And don't forget, if you're catching the audio version of the show, I want to let you know that you can now watch the episodes on YouTube. Subscribe to the show over at youtube.com/basedonatruestorypodcast, or you can chat about this episode in the Based on a True Story Facebook group. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.